And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
You are now tuned into anything potable, the most honorable, the most audible. Hold the applause, like Paul Pierce when he was fresh out the hospital, like Antoine when he shimmied after shots went through. So tell me why you mad even. Your team gonna be sad leaving after matching up with Brad Stevens. Gang green, it's no other way. So tune in to the pod if you plan on staying up to date. You heard? Aziz. AJ, I see you, man.
She. Welcome to
Boston Celtics podcast here on the Athletic Podcast Network. This podcast is brought to you by DirecTV Stream. Get your TV together with the best of live and on demand. Learn more at directtv.com. I am your host, Sam Jam Packard. I call myself a professional sports fan. I am joined, as always, by the kid, the god, the legend himself, Jay King, Celtics beat reporter from The Athletic. And we are joined by a very special guest. From Sports Illustrated, the host of the Open Floor podcast, also just wrote an excellent profile of Kevin Garnett for GQ. Also,
and he used to have hair follicles.
He's a well-known Jay King skeptic, exactly for comments like that. It's why probably the biggest reason why I appreciate Michael Pina. He doesn't put up with this nonsense Jay King's putting out there. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Jay King skeptic is just a wonderful thing to have on the resume. I got to say, I'm not on the right side of history, so I can sleep well at night.
I disagree there. Let's get into your Kevin Garnett profile, because I think your tweet, like I went to Kevin Garnett's house. Here is my story on a crazy 48 hours. Might have been the greatest sell for a story of all time. I was like, eh? Doesn't matter what he wrote. Like, I'm all the way in on this story. For my first question, did you poo yourself a little bit when he snapped at you for having shoes on inside his house?
It was my initial lead was way more dramatic than that, because it was describing how I actually felt in the moment, which was terrified, frankly. Like, I had no idea what was going to happen. The air in the room. Let me back up for 2 seconds. So we're in his house in Minnesota. He's owned the house since he bought it right before and renovated it right before he was traded to Boston, which he mentioned multiple times and was not happy about that. So it was like clearly like he doesn't live in Minnesota. I don't think that was like mentioned in the story. He lives in Southern California and he has multiple properties, but we were there. He was doing some stuff for the documentary.
Did you go to all the properties?
I did not go. I was only invited to one of the properties.
You're a failure as a journalist.
Well, it was actually, so it was during the pandemic, like height of the pandemic. It was like 13 months ago, I want to say, and like flying to Minnesota was a whole thing.
I'm trying to do the math on when that was. So that was...
It was not a good time in our nation's history.
October of 2000.
October 2020.
Okay, yeah. That was definitely during...
bad times. Yes. So we were there, and I was kind of with a camera crew for most of the first day, and they were filming him as he was just going through memorabilia, and I think a lot of this hopefully will be in the doc. I don't know what they cut out or anything.
Are they going to have Pina in the doc? Cut.
So I was in the rough cut of the doc. Don't know if I'm in the final cut. Find out tomorrow night. Very excited. Can't wait to watch it. But anyway, so when I first saw him, he came up to me and he was like, "Hey, you look familiar." And I'm like, I don't know what that means. I've never met you before. I told him that I covered the Celtics, like a few Celtics games in like 2012, 2013 era. So he was still on the team and he was skeptical about that. So like we got on a very interesting note. He's very intimidating.
He didn't believe you that you covered the Celtics.
He was like, you look familiar. And I was like, maybe this is why. And he's like, that's clearly not it. I was like, okay, cool. Well, then I don't know where we go from here. But so, you know, following him around his house, he's going through the memorabilia. We're about 2 hours into it. Go upstairs to his office. He's pointing out, I describe it in the piece. He has got this gigantic Larry O'Brien painting. This like beautiful artwork, and he's just like going, he's like in a trance talking about it, staring at it. It's incredible. And then it was just like literally the air in the room shifted. I can't even describe it. He looks at my feet. I'm like, oh my God. And he's like, do you see that the floors are white? And I'm like, yes, I do. I'm going to immediately back out of this room. but he was so, I mean, he's just like, he's one of the funniest people I've ever spoken to. No exaggeration. One of the most intense people. Everything about him is what you would expect from reading stories about him, seeing him. He's not like, you know, spitting as he talks like he would when he was on a basketball court or anything like that, but he's very energetic, very on 10. And then he can also, at the drop of a dime, just like be super reserved, super quiet. His voice will drop. He'll be really reflective. So just a fascinating guy. But I think everybody who's followed the league for years already knows all that.
How did you bring up the Honey Nut Cheerios thing? Because like, did you just flat out ask him, like, did you say that
absolutely
shit about Lala,
not.
Kevin?
Absolutely
I know you
not.
Did, Kevin.
No, I absolutely did not do that. What happened was I basically said, like, you've reportedly said some things on the court that are controversial. You're 5 years removed from your career now. Is there anything that you said that, you know, you wish you could take back or anything that you'd like to clear up about what you said to different players over the years? And then he was like, absolutely not, except. And then he went in to talk about the Honey Nut Cheerio situation, which I immediately was like, this is obviously going to get picked up and aggregated. So that's great. I hope you don't say it to any other outlet for the next year. So, and he didn't, which was wonderful. But no, I did not go in there with ask Kevin about Frosted Flakes and Honey Nut Cheerios. That was not on the agenda.
Did you go in there?
I'm a Frosted Flakes guy. That story isn't believable. Every part of it's believable except, like, I'm not a Honey Nut Cheerios guy, you know. like that, I love that that's the detail. He's like, see, that proves my innocence.
Did you go in there with any plan, or was it just like, I'm gonna go in there and just react to whatever this guy gives me? Because it feels like he can just drop just gold on you and you just have never known when it's coming. Like, do you know the feeling when it's you're just in the dark feeling around? Do you know the feeling of sprinting through that and hitting everything? Like, is he just dropping gems on you like that constantly? How do you prepare for something like this?
So I had, you're right, it was like a really tough, like preparing for it was tough because it's Kevin Garnett. Like, he's a 15-time All-Star. He's 45 years old. He's got 20 years in the league. You can go in a million different directions with what you want to talk about. And I had like, I don't know, 80 questions written out in my notebook as I sat across from him at his kitchen table. And I just kind of went through the stuff that I've always been most fascinated about when I think about KG. So like that thing about, you know, him talking about running through the dark, whatever he said, like running through the darkness and whatever you hit. Like, that question was just like, hey, man, like, how do you separate the fact that you're, I think this was the question I asked, was like, how do you separate you being this like quiet, like off the court, you're very quiet, you're private, you don't want anyone to know anything about your personal life. But then on the court, you were like a live wire. You were super raw, super emotive. How do you kind of jive those two different personalities in your head? And he was just like, that I was not expecting that deep of a question. And then he's like sat back for a second and he gave me that answer. And I was like, okay, here we go. This is going to be a fun interview.
He might have the best analogies of all time. That they don't really make sense, but they also make perfect sense at the same time.
No, when I was researching it, it was like, and I'm sure you guys remember this, but like he had so many baked cake analogies throughout the years, particularly when he was in the Celtics. And I wanted to ask him like what those mean and what he was going for with any of them. But I was like,
cakes.
I had a feeling that he would just say like, you try to anticipate like what questions are going to get like one word answers or head nods out of this guy. And I had a feeling that the anything about baked cakes and me like reciting questions and analogies that he said in the past, he was not going to be really trying to revisit. So I avoided those.
I was kind of sad when he brought up the Steve Nash Suns thing, because Steve Nash playing with Kevin Garnett would have just been ridiculous. And obviously the Celtics in those years were incredible too. But I think Steve Nash and Kevin Garnett as a pick and roll duo, and Kevin Garnett there to just erase all of Steve Nash's defensive mistakes, would have been so much fucking fun that I'm a little sad it didn't happen.
Yeah, so we got into that conversation. So I met him. So there was basically two parts for the interview. It was like, went to his house in October, hung out for a day. Next day we went to George Floyd Square, and then I flew home. And then it was probably like, I want to say 4, 5, 6 months later, where we hopped on a video call for like 45 minutes. And I got to ask him a bunch of follow-up questions from the initial interview. And I wanted to go back because we talked a little bit about Kobe and the Celtics and regret in the first interview. And I wanted to dive back into that. And then he brought up, or maybe I brought up, I was like, weren't there three teams? Wasn't Phoenix one of the teams? Can you just take me back to that time in your life? And then, yeah, he went off and I basically just quoted him verbatim on what the situation was there with Nash and Sarver. And he still like is, you know, he's not like salty about it, but he's just like, yeah, that would have been fun. Like, and they didn't want to pay me, which is just like absolutely, well, everything we know about Robert Sarver in the news right now, that all checks out. So yeah.
Sarver, yeah.
Seems I mean, like he also a great guy. Could have ended up with the Lakers, it seems like, if Kobe wasn't in China being a businessman. I was just, like, I don't know if I've heard that story before, but it was, man, that would have wildly changed Celtics history.
Yeah, you know, what was really helpful in preparing and doing the interviews for the story was Kevin had this memoir come out. I don't know if you guys have read it. It's like Kevin Garnett A to Z or something like that. And it's really entertaining. It's wild. It's a wild book. I recommend it to anyone who likes KG, but I got an advanced copy of it and was able to highlight the most, just the wildest stuff I would say that was in there. And the things that really made my eyebrows go up and him talking about Kobe and just like, missing a phone call. I was like, you wrote about this a little bit in the book, but like, can you please elaborate? Because this is absolutely wild that if Kobe Bryant just answered your phone, like a phone call, he said he called him like 16, 17 times. It's like answer one of the phone calls, like the whole NBA history is
Kevin
different.
Garnett's
it's
like
wild.
That scene from Swingers. leaving voicemails. Kobe, I just wanted to talk to you. I know I called you 3 seconds ago, but just trying to get back in touch. Call me back.
Yeah, so
baking cakes.
so that was all really, I mean, that's fascinating stuff for anybody who's like an NBA historian or who was alive at the time when he was going back and forth between the Lakers and the Celtics and which one he was going to go to. And I mean, the rest is history, and those two teams battled in two finals in 3 years, and it was awesome. But you think about, like, who go back to that time in the NBA, and I don't know, that would just have been, like, KG and Kobe together, just, like, absolutely unstoppable. That no one's beaten that team.
I'm going to go against that a little bit. I think,
ooh, okay.
Oh, Jay King's being oppositional?
Basketball wise, that's like obviously ridiculous fit. And at that point, they were just absurdly talented guys. I think personality wise, they were too alpha. They were both too alpha. They would have absolutely butted heads in some way. And I feel like Powell was better at that time, personality wise, for Kobe. And Paul Pierce and Ray Allen were better personality wise for Kevin Garnett than Kobe would have been.
So what I'll say to that is KG actually thought of that and he kind of addressed it. And he was like, early in our careers, it wouldn't have worked. At that point, Kobe was so desperate to win a title without Shaq. KG was so desperate to like do anything in the postseason that sacrifice at that stage in their careers was definitely something that was both of their minds. So they're arguably the two most intense maniacal players in NBA history. So I can see it not working, sure. But I can also see it just being wildly successful where these two are just like, it's like iron sharpening iron.
Yeah, and I feel like to some extent the Celtics in those years kind of were that. Like it wasn't Kobe, obviously, but they just had a bunch of competitive maniacs. It was like Tony Allen, Rajon Rondo, Kendrick Perkins, Kevin Garnett, like just guys who were as tough as it gets, Paul Pierce. So I do feel like to some extent iron sharpens iron. And if you talk to any of those guys from those teams, they talk about just how ridiculously competitive every single thing was. So maybe that's how it would have worked out. They would have been perfect for each other. But I just feel like
KG didn't need Kobe the ball,
and KG. Though. Yeah, but he's just a maniac. Like he tried. They're both control freaks in different ways, I feel like.
And so this is what I think. So it's hard to go back and think about who would be on the roster for the Lakers if he goes
Slava
there. Like
Medvedenko would have been elite.
Yeah, but I don't know if he would have made the cut. But like, is Bynum? Does he go to Minnesota then? Is that like, or would Bynum still be in LA? I'm trying to like think about how the trade would have been configured to get KG.
Would it have been Lamar, Kobe, KG? Because that's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
Kevin McHale ever traded KG to the Lakers though? Wasn't there like a big thing where he's just like refused to negotiate with them on anything?
I don't remember that.
You know, the things are said. I don't, you know, I think like
I'm gonna
even
Google
today
that right now.
There's like anti-Celtics people who say that Danny Ainge's relationship with Kevin McHale is the only reason that trade happened. And I don't think that is necessarily true, but I'm sure it helped get a deal done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, the Celtics would have sucked if they just had Ray Allen and Paul Pierce for that kind of run there.
Oh, it would have been Garnett for Bynum and Lamar Odom, according to an old story.
They still would have dominated. I mean, so the best team in the East then would have been like the Cavs, right? Like LeBron with like,
or the Magic with Dwight.
Mo Williams.
Yeah, the truth. Don't hate on Mo. Antoine Jamison was sick too.
Doug, stop right now. It's absolutely not true.
Zydrunas.
So yeah, no, I but Sasha I think Pavlovich. That you're just proving
Jamario Moon.
Yes, exactly.
You're just looking at a roster right now.
I'm not. I renewable.
Oh, the last thing about the KG story is did he bring up the time he hung out with Biggie in the Cleveland All-Star game in 97? Or like, was that in his book? Where did that gem?
That was one of 80 peanut questions. That did you ever hang out with Biggie?
He asked so them all of his subjects.
And how many women did he have hiding under his jacket?
So the Biggie story is in the book very briefly. So I was like, tell me the Biggie story. Because in the book, I think it's just like, saw Biggie invited me up to his hotel suite at my first All-Star weekend and to smoke weed. And I said, no, and I regret it. And I was like, okay, so you write this. Can you just please tell me the story? And one of the funniest things about interviewing KG is, when he tells stories, it's like, it's just, there's really nothing like it. Like, this is unrelated, but I was once at a press junket for Uncut Gems, and I was in a room in New York with KG and Adam Sandler and like probably 10 journalists. And KG had the room in stitches telling stories about just like random stories about being on the set filming the movie. And like Adam Sandler, obviously one of the funniest people of all time, is just like peeing his pants laughing. Like he cannot hold it together. It was like KG was easily the funniest guy in the room. So when he was telling me that story, when he was telling me the Kobe story, it's like half a dozen
when
stories
he started
like
talking
that
about
where I'm just
Arnold Schwarzenegger ejaculating.
He just like can't keep it together. Thank God I had a mask on in his house for that interview, because I was just like, I can't do this. I'm not that professional. So
I love his use of invisible props. Like it feels like anytime he talks about something, he'll like, what was he like putting on a silk jacket or something? And like, he feels like a very vivid speaker, and he's a very willing to just grab anything out of the air and be like, this is, and use that whatever metaphor that is, whatever crazy metaphor that comes into his brain.
Yeah, it was tough to like get that on the page, honestly, because it's like, all right, do we just put in brackets here, breathes fire? Because that's what he did while he was speaking.
That was not
spits fake Gatorade. Like, what do we do here?
Could you reenact it, what he did right now?
I'm not going to do that because Packard told me that we're live on YouTube. And so I'm not going to embarrass myself in front of all
you have
your millions of listeners.
You have to breathe fire like KJ breathe fire.
but stuff like that was just, it's just, yeah, he's just a one of one human being in so many different ways.
If you guys haven't read it, go check out Pina's profile of KG on GQ.com. It's a great read. We haven't covered nearly all the stories in that, and I would highly recommend it.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Now, this is a Boston Celtics podcast talking about the Boston Celtics in the here and now. And the Boston Celtics might not suck, which is a good thing. It turns out having a emotional, not very beneficial, not productive team meeting is all they needed to fix the defense, because in the four games since that team meeting, what have they held teams to under 80 or under 93 times? And then they had whatever the Mavericks game was. I guess. Yes, they lost that 107 to 104 because Luka hit a game-winning three, which I did predict exactly. When we picked every single game this season, I predict Luka would hit a walk-off three there. So I just want to put that out there. But, Jay, you wrote an article about this for The Athletic. What has changed with the Celtics defense, and, like, why are they all of a sudden just so much better than they were in, like, the first eight games of the season?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons. They're just clearly more cohesive defensively. And I think, obviously, Udoka was having them switch, like, basically everything at the beginning of the season, and part of that was just he wanted to get them used to it. He's dialed that back a little bit, but I also think they're still switching a lot, and there's just so much that goes into being a good switching defense that probably doesn't get understood very well. Like, you have to be on the same page with everything. You have to pre-switch sometimes so you have the right matchup. You have to scram switch on the back end so that you don't have, you know, someone mutilating a small guard in the post. You have to, like, know when someone's cutting. Do I stay with him? Do I send him to the next guy? There are so many different things that go into it that I think Jaylen Brown and Al Horford missing time in preseason and not, and some of the guys like not being able to kind of work on all that stuff really set them back for a while. And it took them a little while to figure all that out. But their defense has been awesome over the last like 5-6 games.
It also feels like they're just switching less. Like they were really committed to switching 1 through 5 in the first 6 games of the season. They're just doing, like, you're just not seeing Robert Williams out on the perimeter as often as he was. And it feels like Ime has made the adjustment of maybe we don't have to do this every single possession. And I think that's been beneficial as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think like to Jay's point about what goes into switching, like everything he said is spot on. And then also like I think he mentioned this a little bit, but it's like when you're on the weak side, you got to know when to help. You got to know when to shrink the floor against driving lane. It's not just like I switch, I'm on the ball now, my guy passes the ball and like I can kind of clap my hands together, put my hands together, plays over. That's not really what it is. So you saw a lot of breakdowns that way, I thought. And then to your point, Packard, switching 1 through 5 with Robert Williams on the floor, they were just getting pummeled on the boards when he was out on the perimeter. So I think dialing that back a little bit has been helpful. They're first in the entire league in defensive rating over the last 4 games, I believe, with like the 3rd best net rating behind the Clippers and the Warriors over that span. So, you know, some of that is the teams that they played. The Magic certainly aren't good. That helps, but they did beat Miami. The Mavs are kind of so-so. The Raptors offense is terrible. So these things have helped for sure. But I think at the end of the day, like, this team should be trending towards being a top 5 defense. They have the personnel to do it. There's no reason why they shouldn't. And when everybody gets healthy and on the same page, they'll be even better than we've seen so far.
Now, the defense is improving, but the offense is still not great. And there was moments in that Raptors game where the Raptors play in crazy intense defense. I'm sure Brad Stevens was just losing his mind with how much the Raptors were getting into the ball, because that's all Brad Stevens loves in a defensive team.
Scotty Barnes, the legend.
Scotty Barnes, like, the Raptors can throw out like 4-5 guys who are just all above 6'8 and are extremely strong.
He's like 6'8. 240 as a rookie chasing around Dennis Schroeder over screens. Like, good luck dealing with him in 7 years NBA.
And just like going through Romeo Langford on the baseline. He was very impressive. The Raptors offense, not very impressive, but they really turned things up on the defensive end. And I think the Celtics still struggle from a bit of turnovers. Dennis Schroeder just had, I think, 6 terrible turnovers.
He had 8 turnovers.
Well,
maybe 6 worse. Of them were terrible, but the other 2 weren't great either.
It really felt like the Raptors were playing extremely physical defense. And I thought Jason Tatum did a pretty good job of getting into the paint, finding Romeo in the corner, more so in the first half. But it still feels like, despite him having a good game against the Mavericks and scoring a lot, that he's just not scoring at the same level as he kind of were accustomed to. And at what point is it something to get worried about? I mean, we've seen Dame had a ridiculous quote the other day that was like, the league officiating the game this way is like ruining basketball. That's a paraphrase, but we've seen some of the stars kind of struggle with more physicality. Tatum did have a very good game against the Mavericks and kind of seemed like he was back to his old self. But at what point do you start having a big enough sample size to be concerned about Jason Tatum's lack of scoring? Because the Celtics, for as good as their defense is going to be, they're going to go as far as Jason Tatum basically takes them offensively, because they just don't have enough shooting on this team to kind of sustain long runs with him being this inefficient.
Yeah, I mean, when I watched Tatum this season, I think a lot of stars have been disappointing from the jump. There's probably like 6 or 7 I could rattle off the top of my head who are just super inefficient for whatever reason. Their shots aren't falling. I think officiating has a large element and a reason for it. I'm not going to like get too bogged down in the shooting numbers. I think the shot selection can certainly change with him. And that's just been a career long Even coming out of college, the fear was, you know, this guy's in love with the pull-up twos, and he still is in love with pull-up twos, and he's still in love with getting in his bag, and he holds the ball a bit too long still, but he's also 23 years old. And I think Brian Scalabrine made this point on Zach Lowe's podcast, like so much of the early success that he had in his career, I think is coloring how we view his development in maybe an unfair way. So I thought like some of the plays he made last night that you referenced, Packard, like getting into the paint, kicking a Romeo, kicking a Grant Williams in the corners, spraying it out to even like shooters above the break where you were putting yourself in a position to get a hockey assist. He was making those plays. He was getting off the ball pretty soon against that aggressive defense that Toronto plays. And I know that even like Fred VanVleet is just like his arch nemesis. He hates playing Fred VanVleet going back to the bubble. It's like does not want to dribble around him. But yeah, I think he's kind of settling in. For me, every time I watch him play, it's more about how often are you getting to the free throw line. And that really hasn't happened yet, but it hasn't happened for a lot of guys around the league as they kind of adjust to how the game is being officiated this season.
Yeah, the element to me that's really interesting is that Tatum is growing as a playmaker, and they want him to spray the ball out to the perimeter, and they want him to do that in a timely fashion. They want him to make quick decisions and all that. And then, like you said, it's kick out to Romeo Langford, kick out to Grant Williams, kick out to Dennis Schroeder. Like, it would be so much easier for him if he had knockdown shooters in at least a few positions.
Well, he does have Romeo Langford, so let's be honest here.
That's fair. I'm just saying, though, teams are selling out to stop Tatum drives. Like, just when you see the defense on Grant Williams, for example, and he's shot okay for the season, although
no, he hasn't. He's trending, forgotten how to shoot.
trending very much in the wrong direction. Like, teams just don't care about guarding a lot of the Celtics players. And even Romeo Langford, he's shooting close to 50%.
Exactly 50%.
And nobody cares to guard him because he hasn't proven it and hasn't done it in a large enough sample size. So that's one element to me that's going to be really interesting. Like, how do the Celtics alleviate some of that pressure on Tatum and give him easier looks? And maybe start knocking down shots around him. I think they're shooting like 33% from three as a team. And obviously part of that is just he's been shit from the three-point arc. But a lot of that, too, is the guys around him just aren't threatening.
And what I got to give Josh Richardson credit. I've been slandering him for the entire season. But
he's had two unbelievable blocks the last couple of games.
Yeah, after the Celtics had a run there where they had like a bunch of amazing defensive plays that came – immediately after their own terrible turnovers. And that's something that's called a Jam Packard special in pickup basketball. When you make an awful play and then you have to hustle back because you feel badly about yourself. But Richardson's been okay on the offensive end, knocking down some threes, but I still don't get why Nesmith doesn't play in turn. And this is a debate we've been having.
Are you in the Nesmith fan club, Pina?
Yeah, how big are you on Aaron Nesmith, and do we need to get his old AAU coach from South Carolina in here, who's been a guest on the pod multiple times, to defend his honor?
I don't lose sleep over Aaron Nesmith's playing time, personally. I see a lot of it on Celtics Twitter, and I appreciate the enthusiasm. Like, in these situations, Ime Udoka has all the information, and he knows way more about basketball than I ever will. And if he doesn't think that Aaron Nesmith is deserving of minutes right now for whatever reason, then I trust that. And I trust that Josh Richardson, like, there might be higher value this season in having someone like Josh Richardson, who's probably a better player today than Aaron Nesmith is, really functioning and finding his role in the rotation on the team. So I don't really get too bogged down in Aaron. I mean, you know, you should have just drafted Sadiq Bey, then you wouldn't be in this mess. That's my personal view about it, but, you know, it is what it is.
I was captain of the Bayhive for the duration of his college career, and almost covered him. Almost, sort of.
I mean, I think the question is, like, how do you talk about not surrounding Jason Tatum with enough shooting, and it's like, you're looking for solutions in terms of who do you put out there, because the Celtics have been very good with Robert
Williams.
There
are no solutions.
That's the issue with the roster construction, is they've been pretty good with Horford and Robert Williams on the court. And so it's like the double big is somewhat working, but that doesn't really provide you with a lot of shooting. Horford is not shooting great from three. Like, the starting lineup's been pretty solid, but if you just think of like, okay, now we're going to go one big, who are the other wings we kind of want to put there or just have in the corner? In terms of play, you have Josh Richardson, who feels like your defensive option. There's no real clear go-to guy to kind of be that three-point shooter. I think it's Romeo Langford at this point, because Dennis Schroeder is a wild card. I think he's shooting 34% from three, but he does some crazy things. So he gets to the hoop. He can be, I think, that nice playmaker off the bench, but I don't think he's like the necessary solution for the crunch time lineup, although he's been that guy that Ime's gone to this year. I would imagine that the ideal kind of closing lineup is Smart, Jaylen, Jason Tatum, a big of your choice, but I don't know who that kind of fifth guy is. I think it could potentially be Nesmith, but I think Romeo could be there as well. You want someone who can kind of play both sides of the basketball. And right now it just seems to me Richardson's only a kind of a defensive option.
Yeah, I mean, I hear all that, and it's – look, like, in today's league, if you don't have respectable outside shooting, it's going to make life harder for yourself. But at the same time, like, you also can't just run half-court offense with, like, Langford in the corner and Grant Williams in the other corner, and you're running a high pick-and-roll with Tatum, and the defense knows what's happening. I think that was, like, Marcus Smart's functioning criticism after that game, where, look, like, the other team – knows what we're trying to run. You throw the ball to, you run that like wing action or horns action, excuse me. And you get the ball to Tatum on the elbow, and he just kind of surveys the floor, and then a double comes or whatever, and he's got to kick it. It's like, you would like to see just more body movement. I like that back screen that, or the pin in that Marcus Smart set on Romeo's first three, I want to say, last night. That was like a nice little play. Just like move around and see some more activity, particularly when Tatum starts his drives or Jaylen starts his drives. And then those guys have to keep their heads up. And if you just continue to drive, kick, and churn through the offense, I think everything will be fine. But this offense isn't built to be stationary, because like you're right, these guys are not knockdown shooters, and nobody's going to respect them if they just stand still like statues. You like that one? I think I was the first person to ever use that simile, so
Kevin Garnett would not appreciate that.
No, he needs something much more active where he can pantomime something.
Stand still like my heart when I was thinking about getting traded from Minnesota.
Now, Jaylen Brown is out for the next, 8 days or so with a hamstring. He seems to be very positive about everything, but you mentioned kind of the offense. The offense did not look great last night in general, but it looked even worse with Tatum on the bench. Jay, what do like the Celtics need to do to kind of like survive the next 4 or 5 games without Jaylen Brown? Is it something to worry about also, because he's kind of had hamstring issues, I think, a number of times throughout his career?
I think you just got to play defense. Like, because there are
holding teams to 85 is like a pretty good solution to that.
When Tatum is not in the game and Jaylen's out, like, there just are not a lot of offensive minded options for the Celtics to go to. When Tatum hit the bench, you saw the Raptors, like, they threw on a full court press. It was like they threw it back to the 7th, 8th grade CYO days. And we're just chasing after him full court press style, because they just didn't have any ball handlers really outside of Schroeder. I think Smart was on the bench at that point too. And so it's just going to be really difficult to manufacture points while Jaylen is out during those moments, at least when Tatum is on the bench. So I think it's defense. Honestly, like, you look at this team, they obviously tried to maximize their defense and toughness and versatility during the offseason. That's why they prioritized Richardson. That's why they extended him. That's why they loved the Schroeder fit when he became available. Like, they wanted to get guys who were tough and ferocious. And so now you're stuck with a lineup that doesn't have a lot of shooting, but can defend and is tough. And so they got to really squeeze opponents' offenses dry while Well, Jalen is out because they ain't going to score a lot of points unless they get hot from three, unless Grant starts fucking pouring them in there.
Or unless they play Neesmith. Michael Pina, this is going to be a question. I'm going to channel my inner bad beat reporter. Talk about Robert Williams.
That was very much channeling a bad beat reporter.
I never ask questions in that form, but now I really never will, because now I know how it feels to be on the receiving end of one. I mean, Rob Williams is a delight. He's awesome. I mean, on the offensive, you just see him when he's like really dialed in and really, I mean, I know that the Raptors, we don't want to go off one game too much because the Raptors were super small and Kem Birch didn't play. And he just feasted on the offensive glass in his activity. It was just like, it really set the tone in the first quarter. But like, I mean, this guy is, I mean, I go back to like that Knicks game. Was that the season opener? They just throw him on Julius Randle. No one can touch Julius Randle in that game. You just throw Rob Williams on him and Julius Randle is just like, he goes cold for the whole stretch. And he just does things. He has physical gifts that there's like a very few players in the league, in the world, who can be as athletic as he is, be as, this guy jumps out of the gym. He can switch one through five if he wants to. I don't think that's in the best interest of the team. But, you know, he could lead the league in blocks. He could be one of the league's best rim protectors. He could be one of the league's best rebounders. All the physical tools are there. Offensively, I mean, I don't know what the best way to use him is definitively right now, but I would love even more of him just being a traditional dive man to the rim and like diving hard every time. That would be wonderful. And, you know, when he does leave his feet, land on both feet, that would also be terrific if he can learn to do that consistently. But like the passing, eventually, hopefully he'll develop a reliable 12-footer or something like that. I just love watching him play. Every time he has the ball in his hands or every time he's near it, anything can happen. He's a joy. I love it. What's he lead the league in field goal percentage right now?
Yes. Oh, yeah. 72.3%. Do you think the Celtics need to change the way they use him? I know you mentioned diving more. But like his assists are down, his scoring opportunities when you look at per 100 possessions are down pretty substantially. I think it's like 3 field goal attempts per 100 possessions, just about. It feels like a lot of those, like the Raptors game, he had a great game. Most of it was just he went and got other people's misses and then put back stuff himself. Doesn't seem like they're running as many pick and rolls for him or running as much offense through him.
But like you look at around the league at some of the better bigs who just like really bring value to their teams right now in really tight roles, and it's like he could be a better Clint Capella. He could be at some point maybe he's not as big as DeAndre Ayton, but you watch what DeAndre Ayton does when DeAndre Ayton's role is really confined and he's super effective. So like, you don't need Rob Williams to have this high usage. You don't need him to be a control tower from the elbows on every possession like Al Horford's been used for years. He can do that stuff. But like right now, I think simplifying things for him on offense and just maximizing his ability, his athletic ability, and not giving him too much to handle would be like terrific stuff. And just him developing like top-notch pick and roll chemistry with someone like Schroeder when someone like Tatum is on the bench and you can just run stuff off of that really like basic action and get good shots. I think that would be really helpful, especially like when he's in the short role in those situations where you are trapping a Tatum or you are blitzing a Jaylen Brown on those high screens or those side pick and rolls, like he can make decisions. So you don't need to force it. Just like kind of let him flow through the game. I think that's the best way to utilize him, if any of that makes sense.
Yeah, it feels like they haven't been as aggressive in terms of just trying to get him the basketball there. Like last season, it felt like they were wildly ambitious in some of the lobs they were throwing to him. But I just do think it'll be so much more dynamic if teams are just worrying a little bit, stepping into the paint a little bit on pick and rolls just to try to deal with the kind of diving Robert Williams. Maybe Grant Williams will have that extra 0.5 second and really knock down that three from the corner then. But it does feel like that they like the more he's involved in the offensive end, kind of the better the Celtics offense is. It feels like we've covered a lot of the Celtics topics, but I think we just need to talk about Marcus Smart's foul at the end of that Mavericks game and what the hell that was and what Ime's response was. I still don't really understand what happened, but I won. It was an awful foul. It makes absolutely no sense. I'm pretty sure Marcus Smart is to blame for it. But two, the amount of the people who were outraged and furious with Marcus Smart after the game also amused me, because there was a number of things that led to that Celtics loss. Marcus Smart just played a large role in it, but people were just furious with Marcus Smart. Admittedly, it was very, very dumb, and I still don't understand why it happened. Jay, maybe you can help us out there. But
I would guess just a brain fart, because you had a foul to give, but also there was a shot clock differential, and you kind of want the last shot in that situation. But it's too bad.
Would they have 6 seconds?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah, they would have had 6 seconds. They would have been able to respond after, or at least have a chance to respond after Luka ripped their hearts out, because there was no way he was ever missing that shot. But I think it was too bad for Marcus Smart, because he was so good defensively in that game. He was hounding Luka Doncic. He was like the play he made to pick Jalen Brunson's pocket when, you know, he like veered over and did that. He was sending doubles at the perfect time. It was a masterpiece until that one brain fart from Marcus Smart. I think his defense has been really, really good this year after probably a down year by his standards last year.
So what did refresh my memory? What did Ime say about that?
Somebody asked him about
the
strategy.
He said it was his fault. Like he took the bullet for it, or what was it?
Yeah, it was classic. Like, I'm not taking the blame for this, but also it's my fault.
I'm the coach.
He said that some players asked him whether they should foul, and he told the players who asked, no, don't foul. But he didn't address the group as a team not to foul, probably just thinking that nobody in their right mind would foul in that situation.
Or he did, and Marcus just didn't listen. And then he had to say that I said it out loud. I don't know if all the players in the huddle were listening.
Yeah.
But it got so ridiculous, because people, admittedly, it was very stupid, but then people were like, Marcus Smart, terrible end of the game there. Like, how dare he try to draw that foul on Kristaps Porzingis and then shoot the ball? Like, people were so furious with the brain fart that they said that, like, him drawing contact, which was very obviously a foul, last two-minute report came out, they said it was a foul. They're like, your friend B-Rob, Michael Pino's like, he can't go up with that shot. I was like, he got body checked by Kristaps Porzingis.
They
like,
get a shot at the Winning Plays podcast.
That's normally Jay's role in this, but I thought it was just absurd to be like, you can't go up with it after you get body like just checked in the by Kristaps Porzingis.
Me and B Rob, that's where we've been deferring on Marcus Smart for Marcus Smart's entire career. I'm just like, I've learned to take the bad with the good. That's just who Marcus Smart is. That's who he's always going to be as a player. It's in his DNA. I really don't criticize the shot selection too much. Some of it's frustrating for sure, but he makes so many brilliant plays in so many different ways that doesn't really faze me. I think everything sort of just evens itself out and nobody's perfect, but that's a very B-Rob reaction to that shot by Marcus Smart.
And it's weird because normally the mistakes come offensively, like it's a shot selection thing. It's
sure.
Something like that versus defensive brain fart. You never see that from Smart. Are you worried with his offensive production so far? Like 32.6% from the field? does that
so you know you? No, I mean, like, it's not great for sure. I think, like, so many players are struggling around the league that I can't get too worked about any, especially someone who, you know, has a past of, I mean, his whole career is a roller coaster ride.
He's never been in the most efficient shooter. Like, he's like, if you look at his career high field goal percentage, I think it's like 42%. That, like, efficiency is not really the name of the game for Marcus Smart. It does feel like, when, especially when Tatum's on the bench, he's Schroeder's provided some of this, but he's like really the only one who can go get into the paint, whether it's posting up or driving, and like get the team a bucket when you just need some, like, some sort of one-on-one. I'm not, like, I don't think there's been a drastic difference in Marcus Smart's offensive game. I guess his percentages are down from, I guess, previous years, but it seems like he's basically doing the exact same thing Marcus Smart's always done.
I think the biggest difference has probably been that he's just not shooting twos anymore. Like, he's taking three twos a game. Almost two-thirds of his shots are from the three-point arc. So it seems like he's really trying to limit what he does inside the arc, and maybe not, maybe that's not the right way to put it, but trying to find different opportunities when he does get inside the arc to create for others. And so I think that's been probably the biggest change offensively. And then, like, if you're shooting two-thirds of your shots from three and you're shooting 28% from three, like, your field goal percentage isn't going to be great. So I think once his three-point percentage normalizes at whatever percent it does, he'll end up probably right around the same efficiency he's typically been, and he'll probably lead the Celtics in assists, and he'll be great defensively, and it'll all be okay. Except all for right. The times when he does dumb shit.
I have two important questions to end the show for both of you. Does Nick Nurse have more kind of petulant child energy or divorced stepdad disappointed energy? Which one would you guys choose?
Do I have to pick one of these?
I love putting the professional journalists on the line for have to like go with my childish antics. I can just go on a rant about Nick Nurse. The guy's the biggest complainer I've ever seen in the NBA. It is absolutely ridiculous. It's just frustrating because it felt like it worked a little bit, but I just get upset every single time I watch a Raptors game that he's just constantly upset and constantly berating the officials. And I won't stand for it. I don't think it's very polite, and it's not very Canadian of him. It doesn't reflect.
To be fair, I don't think he's Canadian. So
isn't he from Iowa or some shit?
I don't know. I don't know, even know where he's from, but he has strong.
He's from Iowa.
Strong disappointed stepdad energy, and I'll leave it at that. You guys don't have to speak on the issue. Jay, famously, you've been in, I would say, the Morris camp. You've written stories about the Morris twins. You're a Mook guy. Would you back them in a fight against the Jokic brothers?
That would be the most epic brawl ever. I mean, I wouldn't give many people a chance against the Morris brothers, because those dudes they deserve their reputation as tough guys. The Jokic brothers are big enough and crazy enough and athletic enough to give them a chance. Like, I need it. I need pay-per-view, the Morris brothers and Udonis Haslam versus the three Jokic brothers. Make it a tag team match. The one thing I really didn't like, though, and I disagreed with, was the Morris brothers. You cannot complain about someone shoving you in the back if you shove them and then immediately turn around
and then turn your back.
Like, you well, can't
commit after committing a borderline cheap shot yourself.
Yeah,
borderline, like, very much a cheap shot.
you cannot complain about the shove in the back if you're just, like, gonna start something and then turn around and walk away. I just, like, what was he supposed to, politely tap him on the shoulder, wait till he turns around and then shove him? I didn't understand that part of the beef.
You also, if you're the Heat, you can't pretend you're tough and then have your GM hold you back when you're waiting outside the Nuggets locker room. Like, that's just not a good look for Heat culture.
I need Brad Stevens to stop like Dennis Schroeder and Josh Richardson from going after Bam Adebayo in a game later this year.
What I will say is I really enjoyed, I don't know if you guys read the press release in detail, but one of the reasons that Jimmy Butler was fined was his refusal to participate and cooperate with NBA security's post-infraction questions and their investigation. So it's just like, it's like Jimmy Butler just like would not snitch is basically what I got from that press release, which I thoroughly enjoyed, I'm sure.
I didn't realize the NBA conducted an investigation after every kind of, is that after every flagrant foul? Like what's the protocol? What triggers an investigation by NBA security?
I'm going to go with this would trigger an investigation. And you got like these two, I mean, I don't even know what to say about the Jokic brothers. They're NBA legends at this point. And the fact that they created a Twitter account and the only account that they follow is Jamal Murray. They don't even follow Jokic. Maybe Jokic isn't on Twitter. I don't know.
They made knew that it was actually their Twitter account. Like just texting with Nuggets reporters to let them know, like, you know that guy threatening the Morris brothers on Twitter?
I don't think the Jokic brothers reached out and be like, that's me. I'm sure Nuggets reporters texted them and asked them.
Nonetheless, I love just proudly taking it on the chest. Like, yeah, I'm the one out there on Twitter threatening the Morris brothers.
I typed in their names in like a Twitter search when all that was starting to go down. And the thing that popped up, like the auto populate, was Jokic brothers knives. And I was like, all right, I'm out. I'm out of this. I don't want to know anymore. This is the end of me and this story.
Whatever you can imagine at that point is probably better than the reality of it. Like just leave it at that. You can't get more details about that. Just got to leave it as like the Jokic brothers did some wild shit with knives at some point in their past.
Yeah, you don't mess with people from war-torn who grew up in war-torn countries. Like it's a general rule you should have. And so I think that's wise words. Michael Pina from Sports Illustrated, host of the Open Floor podcast. Thank you for joining us. Has an excellent profile of Kevin Garnett for GQ. If you guys enjoy the show, please subscribe, rate it, do all those things podcast hosts tell you to do. And I guess my final question is Mike Gorman pronouncing it Cy Ockham? Is that potable?
Why take a dig at Gorman?
Potable!
That's bad form.